Coming up in a minute on the second half of Humankind, we hear from a woman who 50 years ago founded a Catholic worker house to serve the homeless, inspired by the example of Dorothy Day. And more on the spiritual journey of Dorothy Day when Humankind continues in a moment. Humankind is produced in association with WGBH Boston and supported by the Humankind Program Fund.
The works of mercy, the work of feeding the hungry and clothing the naked and sheltering the harborless, and visiting the sick and visiting the prisoner and burying the dead and so on, the means by which we are to be judged by how we have contributed to our fellow man.
The extraordinary life of Dorothy Day, journalist and founder of the Catholic Worker Movement. You're listening to Humankind. I'm David Freudberg.
Mr. Speaker, the Pope of the Holy See.
When Pope Francis addressed a joint session of Congress in September 2015, he honored the lives of four Americans, President Abraham Lincoln, civil rights icon Martin Luther King, theologian Thomas Merton, and Dorothy Day, the writer and activist. Dorothy Day, who died in 1980 at age 83, is best known as founder of the Catholic Worker Movement, which served the poor and advocated for justice. Her granddaughter and biographer, Kate Hennessy from Vermont, tells the story of Peter Morin, a Catholic priest from France, who traveled to the United States in the early 20th century and became an inspiration for Dorothy Day.
My grandmother was a journalist, and she had a lot of experience in laying out a newspaper. She knew how to do it from beginning to end. And so basically what she heard Peter saying was, you need to start a newspaper. And which she did immediately, and
And he wasn't particularly saying that at all.
No, he was just saying, "Please publish a broadsheet of my easy essays," and which she did. I mean, she did publish his easy essays, but she also wrote a lot of other articles that were covering the events of the times. Now, this was 1933. And, of course, the height of the Great Depression, and the U.S. was in huge turmoil at that time. There were so many things going on, hunger strikes, strikes of every nature, people just going through horrific conditions.
I think a fourth of the public was unemployed.
Yes. New York City alone was just inundated of huge numbers of the unemployed and the homeless. And so she was, as a journalist, she wanted to report about this. And so that's how the paper started. From that point on, it just was not what they intended. My grandmother always said they did not intend to start a soup line. They did not intend to open up houses of hospitality, that this just happened because of what they were writing about. People started showing up at their door saying, we need help. And so my grandmother was like, well, sit down. We have more soup on the stove. And then, you know, had to find apartments to put people up. And it just grew and grew and grew.
Once I built a railroad, made it run, made it race against time. Once I built a railroad, now it's done. Brother, can you spare a dime? Once I built a tower.
The soup lines sometimes extended to 1,000 people lining up in New York?
Yes. When they became quite well known, by 1936, they had moved into a building down in Mott Street in Little Italy, and which turned out to be a wonderful neighborhood for them to be in. And that's the neighborhood that my mother grew up in. But there would be days in which the line would extend all the way down Mott Street for several blocks, and it would start early in the morning, you know, at 5 o'clock in the morning, and the men would build fires in the garbage cans to keep warm as they waited, you know, for the soup line to open. So it really it was a huge need at that time.
I'm your pal, buddy. Can you spare a dime?
Dorothy Day speaking at the State University of New York in 1966.
When we started the Catholic Worker back in 1933, it's an 8-page tabloid paper. Comes out once a month, always late. We never charge more than 1 cent a copy. And it deals with the problems of the day. We took the paper from the very first issue out on the streets and sold it on street corners. The fellows and the college students who come to help us still to this day go out and sell it. And over again, as I travel around the country, I have people come to me and say, oh, I bought a copy of the paper in front of Grand Central, or I bought a copy of the paper up by Macy's, and so on. And they get to know the people who sell it, and they get to know the people who get it out. It's a paper which deals very personally with the issues. The people that joined us were young people just out of college at a time when there was great unemployment. So they came and lived, had subsistence. There's never been any salaries paid, but lived together in a small community. And that community grew from the storefront and a few apartments to a large house on the west side, and then finally down the east side in this old tenement house that one of our readers had given us the use of.
Dorothy Day came to journalism partly through the influence of her father, John Day, a newspaper man in Chicago, where the family lived for a time. Later, in New York City, Dorothy worked as a writer, and as a way to practice her faith, she served the community that was attracted to the Catholic Worker.
They'd always get these wonderful people who would come in.
Kate Hennessy, the youngest of Dorothy's grandchildren, authored a family memoir, The World Will Be Saved by Beauty.
There was one time my grandmother supported a seamen's strike. And what that meant is she said to the seamen who are on strike, come to the Worker, we'll feed you, we'll house you. And out of that, this is in 1936, out of that a small group of very important men became part of the Catholic Worker. They came and they stayed for the rest of their lives. And they brought with them a huge amount of skills of how to cook for big numbers, you know, how to farm. There's a saying, scratch a seaman and you'll find a farmer. So there was this small group of people that really took on the tasks that were presented and started baking bread and making soup and making coffee. They always had coffee. No matter how poor they were, they always served coffee. And they were known for serving the best coffee.
So it kind of built on itself.
Yes, and it took off very quickly. It's quite extraordinary. The paper went from a first issue of 2,500 to, by 1936, it was about 160,000. And sometimes going up to, I think there's one issue, it was 190,000. So this was, you know, the ideas caught on like wildfire all around the country, and places, Catholic Workers opened up in other cities early on. In terms of the actual work, I mean, the paper was the voice. It was my grandmother's voice, though she did then start almost immediately to be invited to speak to a lot of seminaries, to high schools, to a lot of groups. And so there's something about what she was doing really caught people's imaginations.
So did the pages of the Catholic Worker reflect this blend of social consciousness and spirituality that had absorbed your grandmother?
Yes, yes. Though she was always a journalist. I mean, she viewed her work as a writer, and she always believed that the Catholic Worker was a paper for your basic reader. It wasn't for theologians. You know, she didn't want the paper to be written by priests, academics. She really wanted it to be a lay paper and very much focused on the here and now. She was covering strikes. She was covering workers' conditions. She was very much concerned with that. She was covering events in the South with segregation. These things she was covering. She was covering what was happening in Germany, you know, what Hitler was doing early on, way before the war, that the U.S. joined the war. So she was really keeping a close eye on all the events of the times. I think that has, that tradition has continued. The paper still is very much involved in covering what's happening in Syria and Iraq with refugees. There's a lot of people at the Catholic Worker who are very involved in these issues. So they really are keeping an eye on the issues of the day.
Dorothy Day sought to follow her Catholic faith, not abstractly, but by living among needy people she wanted to help. Her mentor, Father Peter Morin, had studied the life of St. Francis of Assisi, who saw performing labor as a gift to the greater community, and who advocated the way of peace. Dorothy Day, from 1966.
Peter Morin was opposed to all coercion, all violence. He felt to follow the example of Christ himself, who presented his doctrine to be accepted or not to be accepted, to think in terms of the Beatitudes, to think in terms of the such expectations of man in his humanity, to go ahead and turn the other cheek, to give up his coat when his cloak had been taken from him, to always go the second mile, always to go ahead and to try to work out in practice and in one's life the kind of things that Jesus was talking about in his Sermon on the Mount and in his teaching. As a matter of fact, the whole message of the New Testament was that of universality, that all men were brothers, that God willed that all men be saved, that all men become new men under this new dispensation. So this has been the teaching. And a hard teaching, and certainly one of complete nonviolence. You begin to examine your conscience, and you see how often you yourself are guilty of aggression and bringing out aggressions in others. Very often, even in talking about these things, you arouse aggressiveness on the part of those who hear you. It's very difficult to go ahead and present a talk of this kind without antagonizing. It is controversial because it deals with the very issues that we're suffering from today. The poverty program on the one hand and the war program on the other. The poverty program with its cut, as the New York Times said yesterday, of $250 million in its poverty fund, maybe $1 billion is allotted for the poverty program, $85 billion for the defense program. A terrible and shocking contrast between the works of mercy and the works of war.
Dorothy Day, born in 1897, came of age in the 1910s when she was drawn to the cultural vibrancy and progressive politics of early 20th century New York City. It was an exciting time of discovery for an idealistic teenager.
She had a very strong presence of God when she was a young girl, and this continued all the way through when she was in her teens and her 20s. She was very much involved with the radical and bohemian literary circles of New York City from 1916 to the end of the 1920s.
As you wrote, atheism, anarchism, socialism, vegetarianism, women's rights, free love, free speech, free thought, it was all in the air.
Yes, it was. It was quite an extraordinary time. And I think it's unfortunate that we've forgotten about it. I think that it was overshadowed by the stock market crash in 1929. But before then, it was an incredibly exciting time, I think, to be in Greenwich Village in New York City, which is where she was living.
Well, those of us who lived through the 60s had perhaps an echo of that feeling?
Yes, I think so. Though for my grandmother, the 60s were quite painful. She did not enjoy them as much as the rest of us did.
Therein lies a tale, I'm sure. Exploring the fascinating life of Dorothy Day, a journalist and leader of the Catholic worker movement. You're listening to Humankind. I'm David Freudberg. For more information on the segment, Dorothy Day, and to obtain audio downloads or CDs, please visit humanmedia.org. In preparing her 2017 memoir, The World Will Be Saved by Beauty, Kate Hennessy spent years talking with her mother, Tamar, the only child of Dorothy Day. She worked through family documents and reconstructed her own early encounters with her famous grandmother. What emerged is a very human portrait of Dorothy Day's complicated, passionate, dedicated life.
She was born in Brooklyn when she was 8 or so. The family moved out to the Bay Area, to Oakland. They were in Oakland during the San Francisco earthquake, 1906, lost virtually everything. They then moved to Chicago, and they lived in Chicago until 1917, I believe. And they all moved back to New York City, and that's where she began her career as a journalist.
And that was, of course, during World War One, and during the period when a military draft began in the United States, and that figured prominently in Dorothy Day's life and activism.
Yes, it did. She first started writing for a socialist paper called the New York Call, and during that she met a fellow writer who would eventually be known as Mike Gold. And through Mike Gold, she was introduced to this whole radical generation, really, in New York City, and they were all being drafted. As you say, there was conscription happening. Well, it started to happen, I think, in 1917. And so it was a huge topic, and all these young men were just staying up all night long. What do we do? Do we join? Do we flee? What do we do? And she became involved with an anti-conscription group, a group of Columbia students. She also was working for The Masses, another radical paper, and they were shut down for their views against anti-conscription. She was an absolute pacifist. She said, we have to trust Jesus when he says, you know, love your enemies. She said, we just have to do the best we can. There was always some sort of war going on, and she was very, as a journalist, she was very much interested in the news. She was always reading the paper every single day. I remember her reading the New York Times. So she was always very much aware of everything that's happening around the world in terms of war and the results of these wars and the continuation.
Now that we are in the war, there are only two sides, and the time has come when every citizen must declare himself American or traitor.
One war never ended. It just seemed to go on and on. And so she was very much aware of this long view. And I think that was very difficult for a lot of Catholics, a lot of Catholic workers to understand, particularly with World War II, where it was so clear that there was a very clear enemy and we needed to fight. And she was always saying, well, we have to look at the larger view. I mean, Hitler didn't come out of nowhere. This is a process that we keep going towards. You know, this is an inevitable outcome of all the actions that we take beforehand. So we have to break that cycle. And that was really hard. A lot of young men at the Worker left at that time and joined. A lot of them became COs and worked
conscientious objectors.
Yes, yes. And worked on farms or worked in hospitals. I mean, there was a lot of different ways that people could serve. A lot of the men worked in the ambulance services. And some men actually full-on joined some of the Catholic worker men. And she would publish their letters in the paper. So, I mean, she was very careful to keep these people within the family, even though there was grave differences in terms of what one's duty was. But she also said that you have to follow your conscience. Each person has to find out what their conscience is telling them and to follow that. And if that means going to war, then you do it.
And did you inherit your grandmother's pacifism?
Yes, I did.
Even in the face of evil?
Yes, I do. And that's a really hard thing to explain. You know, there's a lot of mysteries in life. And what really interests me, I think, in many ways, is we keep insisting that we know we have the solutions, we have the answers. And war as an answer, as a solution, I think just leads us down a road that just gets worse and worse and worse. I don't see it as solving any problems. It gets more and more dangerous as we become better and better at making weapons.
Better and better. Dorothy Day was an intimate of several remarkable literary figures, including Eugene O'Neill, the great American playwright, Malcolm Cowley, the novelist and literary critic, and at one point the poet Hart Crane. With Jean O'Neill, she would stroll along the East Side waterfront, where he would explain to her the importance of listening to people's stories and of honoring their dignity.
She always spoke of literary influences. She always spoke of the books that she was reading. It was very influential on my life to grow up with that. It really, these authors were part of her daily life, particularly, I'm speaking of authors that she didn't know, but, you know, Dostoevsky was a very important person for her, a writer. She also had this genius of being able to meet great people. And so it's no surprise to me that she became very good friends with Eugene O'Neill. She just had this way, even though she was 20 years old, she was very young. She was the youngest of that crowd. There was something about her that I think really, she was so able to focus in on very interesting people. And they, you know, responded to that. I think she was also very interesting in herself. I think we can all agree upon that. We're still talking about her, you know, 30 years after her death, but 35 years after her death.
That must be her journalistic instinct, to be able to focus in on very interesting people.
I think so, but I think it's also, it goes deeper than that. I think she just had this great fascination with people. She loved to hear their stories, and that was one of the ways in which I think people who came for help just really responded to her, is that she just wanted to hear their stories. You know, she wanted to hear, where did you come from? What, you know, how did you end here?
And that was genuine.
It was genuine, and people really responded to that. She could draw, my mother would say, she could draw out, you know, anyone, the most, you know, fierce of people that would show up. They would just melt and start speaking to her.
And what do you think underlay that?
I think when there is a genuine interest in a person, when someone realizes that they are truly listening and truly open in a non-judgmental way, just, I want to hear your story. This fascinates me. Please tell me. I think that just opens people's hearts.
And do you think that was integrated with her willingness and ability to accept people regardless of whatever state of disrepair they might be in?
I think so. I mean, she always, you know, she said always that the way that she could see God was in people's faces, particularly people who are suffering. So I think that to her, that was her, it was almost like a spiritual connection, at one level, in addition to the personal connection. And also, you know, she was so, both my mother and my grandmother were, so accepting of everyone. My grandmother could be quite judgmental. I mean, people would take a wrong step and she would tell them. But this just accepting whoever came in, and I think that was one of the extraordinary geniuses of the Catholic Worker, is that it was from the get-go, it was so accepting of whoever showed up at the door. And I mean, there were some very difficult people, but both my mother and my grandmother just had this wonderful ability to be with the most difficult of folks.
I want to ask about being with difficult people, because if you are in a service setting where people who are needy, who may be addicted, who may be struggling with issues of homelessness, who may be facing mental illness, are showing up, there is going to be a certain incidence of difficult people that one encounters.
I think the one word that jumped out at me, that list of ways people can be difficult, is the word needy. I think that probably was the most difficult aspect for both my mother and my grandmother, is facing people's needs much more so than, let's say, mental illness or physical illness or even violence, that this pure naked need that they often were in the direct line of fire was the greatest difficulty. So how do you respond to that need? I think, you know, neither one of them really ever sorted that out completely. And I think it's not only, I think we all kind of have this level of neediness. And how we deal with it, whether we think we are the people giving to others or receiving, I think we all kind of are, it's an equal opportunity state of mind, neediness. And
meaning that at some level we're all vulnerable and fragile?
Yes, yes. And I think that's a really important thing to remember. I talk a lot to college students. And there's a real, I mean, it's a wonderful sense of, you know, they want to go out and do good in the world. And which is, you know, it's wonderful. I don't want to discourage them from that. But I think it really, we have to start from a position that people are going to give to us in these situations. And that we have to always be open to that it's not a situation of us, you know, always helping the other person. I think that you won't get far. A lot of, you know, people who are desperate, people who come to the Catholic Worker are very often very smart people and very clued into what my mother would call, you know, do-gooders. She would kind of spit that term out, do-gooders. So what's the difference between you know, someone who's trying to help and a do-gooder? And I think that's that inner understanding of yourself and your needs and what people are giving to you. I think that's absolutely essential in doing this kind of work.
Kate Hennessy, granddaughter of the late Catholic Worker leader Dorothy Day. She is author of a family memoir, The World Will Be Saved by Beauty. Listening to Humankind, I'm David Freud. Studio recording by Doug Sugars. Editorial assistance from David Cruz, Ken Rogers, and Kathy Graham. Webmaster Brian K. Johnson. Special thanks to Tony Buck. Our program is presented by Human Media in association with Connie Goldman Productions. Program development provided by Chart Media.
To purchase a CD copy of this program, please call 1-800-5-LISTEN. That's 1-800-5-LISTEN. Or visit our website, where you can also obtain an audio download of this and our other programs and can hear selected episodes free. You can access free written materials related to this program as well. Our web address is humanmedia.org. Again, if you'd like to purchase a CD copy of Humankind by phone, please call 1-800-5-LISTEN, and our web address is humanmedia.org.
And you can subscribe at iTunes to our free weekly podcast, Humankind on Public Radio. This segment, Dorothy Day, Part 1, is Humankind Program number 254.
The executive producer is David Freudberg. This is Humankind.
Please join WHFR on Friday from 2 p.m. until 4 p.m. as DJ Kitty Love brings 2 hours of the best in new blues releases and artists from the local Metro Detroit area to the 89.3 FM airwaves. Listen to all hues of blues during the Highway 61 cruise at Henry Ford College Radio, WHFR.FM.
25% of community college students report food insecurity and are going to bed hungry. Shocking, right? A friend sitting next to you in class could be going hungry and you'll never know. The good news, HFC is here to help. The Hawk's Nest has non-perishable food items available for students experiencing hunger. And you can help too by donating non-perishable food items or money. You can be sure that 100% of your donation goes directly back into your college community. Donate today and fill a friend's plate. Go to hfcc.edu and search Hawk's Nest.
Seeing the world through new eyes and the earth from miles above. Not just breaking news, but breaking barriers. Now that's a job for a Girl Scout.
Humankind is produced in association with WGBH Boston and supported by the Humankind Program Fund.
Just because a person is in need, a person is on the street, does not mean that they have nothing to give. I mean, I have met the most amazing people who have had incredible lives, but often due to alcoholism and drug addiction, they lose that. But they haven't lost their brains, they haven't lost their heart, they haven't lost their abilities.
Lessons about caring for people living on the margins, inspired by Catholic Worker founder Dorothy Day. You're listening to Humankind. I'm David Freudberg. Founded in the Great Depression, Dorothy Day's Catholic worker movement to aid the poor has reverberated over the decades since. Centers like the Christie Street location in New York City have inspired more than 200 Catholic worker houses across the United States. Soup kitchens and other facilities, those who come to help, practice voluntary poverty and service to the needy. That was the vision of Kathy McKenna, a recent college graduate in 1966. With the man who would become her husband, Kathy founded Haley House in Boston's dilapidated South End. Although the surrounding neighborhood has now largely gentrified, Haley House, with expanded services, is still going.
When John and I first moved into Upton Street and started living with men from the street, we were absolute pacifists, and our philosophy was, you know, just love. And of course, after the first day and the first bottle thrown against the wall, it was like, well, we better have a rule about no bottles in the apartment. And day two and day three, et cetera, et cetera. But I also remember the first time, John had already been to Christie Street, but the first time I went down to Christie Street and a friend of ours was on the house. And I remember him and a pal bodily removing a guest who was creating disturbance. And I was so shocked. I was like, where's this absolute pacifism here in the Catholic worker, right here at the heart of it? And that, of course, became, for us in a soup kitchen setting, day in and day out, a constant struggle. What do you do with the person who is acting out, who is harming himself or others? I don't think it was ever resolved, ultimately resolved. But what I took eventually was, the thing that mattered was our intention toward that person. If we were insulted and angry that this person was making my life harder and just wanted to get him the hell out of there, that would be a really unproductive interaction, whether it was done, you know, externally from a peaceful perspective or violently. But if we really cared about this guy and we really held high expectations for him and we didn't want him, because for the most part this happened when people were drunk, and we knew when we were going to see these guys the next morning, and if they had smashed somebody's face open, whether it be another guest or a volunteer, they were going to feel terrible tomorrow morning. So why would we just be in a situation where we would allow that to happen? To me, it became a case of not intervening was a way to disrespect the person's highest goals for himself.
In the sense that they were sort of crying out for some boundary to be set.
Well, even if they weren't crying out for it, the situation was crying out for it. And knowing how often we had coffee in the morning with people who were regretting what they had done the night before.
Were there cases when you were able to allow the person to feel truly cared for and respected that it did defuse the situation?
Absolutely. Not always, for sure, but absolutely there were times. At those times when I was in the best place, when I was the most in touch with my own motivation and my own words and actions and how they were coming across, absolutely it had a huge difference in people's response, in the guest's response.
Today, more than 50 years since it was established, Haley House operates a soup kitchen, food pantry, elder meal site, more than 100 units of affordable housing, an urban farm, and the Haley House Bakery Cafe. Most recently, they opened Dudley Dough, an inner-city workplace that offers a living wage for employees and, for customers, healthy pizza. Dorothy Day, speaking about a French Catholic priest who was a guiding light for the Catholic worker movement.
Peter Morin pointed out that this very basic duty of the Christian was to share with others and by voluntary poverty get rid of his superfluous goods. And while men were hungry in the world, to go ahead and do everything possible to feed them, where they were without homes to shelter them, and to contribute by one's work and by one's attitude of one, towards one's work to the common good of the world. There's a basis of meeting with all, whether they're believers or unbelievers, whether they're agnostics or whether they call themselves atheists, that on the very ground of the common good, men can meet together and try to solve these problems. The works of mercy are laid down in the 25th chapter of St. Matthew, the work of feeding the hungry and clothing the naked and sheltering the harborless and visiting the sick and visiting the prisoner and burying the dead and so on. And in the Catholic Worker, we pointed out how the works of war are those of destruction of food, spraying of the crops, defoliating the jungle and the forest, flooding the fields, destroying homes, bombing out villages, the exact opposite of the works of mercy, which are the command, which are the judgment, which is laid down in the New Testament, the means by which we are to be judged, by how we have contributed to our fellow man, whether by works of war or by works of mercy.
Dorothy Day recorded in 1966. She passed away in 1980. Her granddaughter, Kate Hennessy, recently wrote a family memoir. Kate's mother was the only child of Dorothy Day and grew up in the atmosphere of charitable giving that suffused the Catholic worker movement. In a recent interview, Kate reflected on the importance of developing a humble relationship with a needy person one intends to serve, based on mutual giving and receiving.
I mean, I think it's absolutely essential to have that relationship. I think that we run grave danger in believing that we can give and not receive, that we know the answers, that we know how to fix things. We don't. I mean, these are intractable problems. We live in a very complicated society that has a great deal of grave results in people's lives, and to think that we can sort things out, I think, is very dangerous. In terms of the person-to-person engagements that happen in at the Catholic Worker and at other places, and I think that if you don't open yourself to see who they are, to see what they can give, and it may be something very simple. It may be just a conversation, or it may be maybe they can mop the floors that day. I mean, you know, there's so many different ways that people can give. As my mother would say, you know, hospitality is at the heart of everything that the Catholic Worker does. Hospitality was at the heart of much of what my mother did. So what does that mean, hospitality? You know, I think it is this constant kind of openness to whoever comes in through the door, and that means not just feeding them, but being open to whatever they have to give back. And I think that that very openness, that very relationship, has the seeds for great change within everyone, all the parties of that situation.
And by that, do you mean that receptivity to a person who's struggling helps them to feel like they can find their strengths and become uplifted?
Well, there's no guarantees. Definitely no guarantees. But yes, I mean, there's always the potential for that, always. And I think that to keep your mind open to that and your heart open to that is essential, but also can be, I mean, there's a lot of burnout in this area, you know, of helping those who are truly destitute, because the needs are so great, the resources are so limited.
Did Dorothy Day battle the risk of burnout?
Oh, yes. She was at it, you know, for 50 years. She lived at the Catholic Worker her entire life, and she had ways of dealing with it. She would flee. You know, she believed in when things got too rough, you fled. And she would advise people to do that. She would flee to the beach. You know, she took a great deal of spiritual sustenance from water, from the ocean. So she would go out to Staten Island when she felt that she was becoming too irritable and impatient with people.
How about for you, Kathy? Have you battled the prospect of burnout?
Yeah, of course.
Kathy McKenna, founder of Haley House in Boston.
But I think, you know, built into my life was a more balanced situation. I mean, you know, after the first 6 years we were living across the street, I had a home, kids, husband. There was a balance in my life, a daily rhythmic balance that enabled me to not get so overwhelmed, and I never had the same claustrophobic existence around poor people. I really took advantage of the opportunity to get away as I developed a spiritual practice to get away on retreats and really
physically as well physically, as spiritually.
Physically. And I think some of the teachings that resonated most with me were the ones around this idea that we are all one, that actually, in many ways, there is no separate I. You know, there, you know, we are, whether from a Catholic perspective of the mystical body or a Buddhist perspective of the fact that there is no self and that there is a oneness to all. I think there's even something in Christian scripture that talks about, you know, you don't thank your hand for feeding yourself because it's part of you. It's just expected. It's the natural, it's the natural law. And in some ways, the same thing is true for us as people. If it's only because we see that we're that we see each other as other that gets in the way with our being able to be intimately involved in whether it's another person's needs or another person's gift, not feeling badly if we're on the receiving end and not feeling inappropriate if we're on the we happen to be on the giving end.
We're examining the life of Dorothy Day, a remarkable 20th century journalist who advocated for social justice and service to the needy. She's credited as founder of the Catholic Worker Movement. You're listening to Humankind. I'm David Freudberg. For more information on this segment, Dorothy Day, Part 2, and to obtain audio downloads or CDs, please visit humanmedia.org.
All want to know what made Dorothy Day who she is. What are all the influences that led her to be who we know her as, which is, you know, quite extraordinary.
Kate Hennessy, the youngest grandchild of Dorothy Day.
And when you look at her early life, you know, things happened to her that happened to many women. She had one very difficult and devastating love affair, in which resulted in a pregnancy, and she had an abortion. And the abortion was so traumatic to her that she was afraid that she would never be able to have children again. And this was a huge sadness and wound.
Really haunted her.
Yes, it haunted her. And what that resulted in, that abortion, that experience resulted in, is that she did become pregnant 6 years later with my mother. And that experience was so joyous to her. I mean, it's really, you know, it was an answer to her prayers. She really wanted to become a mother, and the fear of not being able to be one was a huge burden. And in this process of feeling this great joy and gratitude, I mean, that's what opened her heart even more in this quite complex process of conversion, which I think started at a very young age, and not just the birth of my mother, but I think the birth of my mother was an experience, a sacred experience that she was not going to squander, that that she was going to do something, further her life in ways that maybe she wouldn't have, it wouldn't have occurred to her if she had never had a child.
Dorothy Day gradually embraced Catholicism as her faith, a choice that was solidified when she became exposed to her church's social teachings of good works. Through personal struggles, including a failed marriage and two suicide attempts, she took solace from support derived from religion. Much of that journey was recorded in copious diaries maintained over Dorothy Day's lifetime.
I would have to say that the thing that affected me most, about 2 weeks after my mother died in 2008, my grandmother's diaries were published. And about a year after they were published, I was finally able to sit down and read them.
And you hadn't seen them before
that? I'd seen portions of them, but I hadn't sat down and just read the entire book. It's a big book, and it's only a portion of her diaries, of her writings. But I sat down and read that book, and I read it probably in about 5 days. I mean, I really could not stop reading. And the reason I think that this happened is because of this daily sense of something other, something deeper, something mysterious, something beyond what our day-to-day lives, something beyond our understandings of God. I mean, she didn't always write of spirituality, but she wrote in a way that to me exuded spirituality in terms of how she observed the world, both in terms of the natural world and in terms of other people. She had a wonderful eye for detail in her writing, both published and unpublished. And so I started to hear this wonderful voice, this kind of a river of, for lack of a better term, spirituality, just in terms of how she lived in the world. This underlying constant awareness that she had of the sacramentality of life on all levels that made the most impact on me.
And has that impacted you in your own spiritual journey?
Of course. And that spiritual journey is still going on, of course. You know, both my mother and my grandmother are very interesting people spiritually and very different. My grandmother was very much she loved the church. She loved the Catholic Church. She loved the sacraments. She loved the ritual. She loved the language. It was very important to her. You know, communion every day, very important. She said that one's prayer life needs 3 hours a day, and she would wake up early in the morning and read and pray.
And
she loved the Psalms.
You've described scenes where she was with her rosary beads.
Often saw her with her rosary. Apparently, I learned the rosary at her knee, but I don't remember that. I hate it when I lose those great memories. But so there was a daily presence of her religion. My mother, who was not a convert, who grew up Catholic and went to Catholic school, was educated by the nuns, was a very devout Catholic, left the church when she was in her 40s. And so I have grown up with this, you know, two very different paths. And my mother was nature-based. I mean, I call her an earth mother, even though she kind of snorted at me when I would say that. But, I mean, she would just touch things and they would blossom, not only plants, but animals and people. You know, she just had this wonderful way of allowing creatures and plants and children to blossom. So there's, you know, two very different, outwardly different expressions of faith. And, that's been an interesting education for me because for many years I thought they were opposed. I thought they were in conflict. My grandmother was of the church. My mother wasn't. And it's taken me a lot of years to see that there is no conflict. It's just a different expression. And, of course, now I have to find there's a third thread, which is mine, and that's to be discovered.
Wrote Dorothy Day in her autobiographical work, The Long Loneliness. Writing a book is hard because you are giving yourself away. But if you love, you want to give yourself. You write as you are impelled to write, about man and his problems, his relation to God and his fellows. You write about yourself because in the long run, all man's problems are the same, his human needs of sustenance and love. I am a journalist, not a biographer, not a book writer. The sustained effort of writing, of putting pen to paper so many hours a day, when there are human beings around who need me, when there is sickness and hunger and sorrow, is a harrowingly painful job. I feel I have done nothing well, but I have done what I could. Her granddaughter, Kate Hennessy.
She had so much work to do at the Catholic Worker. At the Catholic Worker and all the details that entailed, her writing career, because that's how she earned money for herself, and which she would always give away. She gave everything away. It's amazing. And also taking time to keep family ties strong. I mean, that these things, any one of them would have been a full-time job for anyone, and yet she did them all constantly. She never stopped. Tremendous amount of energy.
You mentioned that she gave everything away. That's so countercultural. in this hyper-consumerist society. Can you explain what voluntary poverty is, why someone would be drawn to that?
I think the definition of voluntary poverty has to be a personal one. Certainly for me, what it's come to mean is living a simple life, living simply. We don't need all of the material goods that we think we need. And there are ways to just kind of, you know, wean ourselves off of that kind of addiction. It really is an addiction, I think, to things. You know, my grandmother never had that addiction to things. She had an extraordinarily loose need for material goods. So she never quite, you know, dealt with that, except for her books. Her books were very precious to her, and they often walked, as many things did at the Catholic Worker. So that was one element that was very painful. It would drive people up a wall, actually. They would give her gifts, and she would just turn around and pass them on. And to her, that's what you did. It was kind of like this gift-giving economy, really, is what she did. And my mother was very much the same way, except that my mother, being a craftsperson and a gardener, had a lot more tools and things that she used. But to me, that also is living simply. I mean, what do we actually need is a really important question.
So voluntary simplicity, does that mean not having any food in the fridge? Does that mean not having a fridge?
Well, there's a difference. My grandmother was very clear. There's a difference between poverty and destitution. People need things. I mean, we need food. We need clothing. We need shelter. She never said those things need to be given up. Now, it does. There's an element of, let's say, instability that can happen, particularly if you choose to be an artist, if you choose to be a musician, if you choose to be a writer. There's a lot of instability, insecurity in that kind of life, and so sometimes there won't be food in the fridge. So you have made a choice. Or you have to choose between being a writer, having a mortgage, you know, so you do make these choices. What does that mean if you don't buy a house? Where do you put yourself up? You know, people face these questions all the time, these kind of decisions. And, you know, these are important decisions because you can put one foot wrong and that will change the direction of your life for decades. You know, take you away from what your vocation is calling you to do. You know, my grandmother talked a lot about vocation.
We have the richest, you might say, life, as well as the poorest life. And I say we dress like lilies of the field. We have shoes that are these kind of handmade shoes that come in, and they happen to fit. So somehow we get the clothes that we need, the clothes that last for a lifetime. And we have what we need, all of us. The Lord provides it. Ask and you shall receive. And seek and you shall find. It happens again and again. And the more you give, the more you receive. I remember in the earliest days of the Catholic Worker, we'd empty out the house where somebody had been evicted, lost all their furniture, and then found another place to live after the city had taken it away and dumped it, I suppose, out in the ocean. And we would have to go ahead and take whatever we had and hand it over to the family. And I'm sure there's the history of most of the lives of those who trust in the Lord and leave it in His hands and rejoice in poverty. There was a philosopher, I don't know whether it was Socrates or not, who said he loved to wander through the marketplace looking at all the stuff he could do without.
Dorothy Day, speaking in 1966. She was a journalist, social activist, and founder of the Catholic Worker Movement. She died in 1980 at age 83. Listening to Humankind, I'm David Freudberg. Studio recording by Doug Sugars. Editorial assistance from David Cruz, Ken Rogers, and Kathy Graham. Webmaster Brian K. Johnson. Special thanks to Tony Buck. Our program is presented by Human Media in association with Connie Goldman Productions. Program development provided by Chart Media.
To purchase a CD copy of this program, please call 1-800-5-LISTEN. That's 1-800-5-LISTEN. Or visit our website, where you can also obtain an audio download of this and our other programs and can hear selected episodes free. You can access free written materials related to this program as well. Our web address is humanmedia.org. Again, if you'd like to purchase a CD copy of Humankind by phone, please call 1-800-5-LISTEN, and our web address is humanmedia.org.
And you can subscribe at iTunes to our free weekly podcast, Humankind on Public Radio. This segment, Dorothy Day, Part 2, is Humankind Program number 255.
The executive producer is David Freudberg. This is Humankind.
These are the sounds of a dinner. A dinner that almost didn't happen. A dinner now served, thanks to people like you. Due to COVID-19, 17 million more Americans may face hunger. Feeding America is helping our neighbors in need. And if you're able, you can too. Donations are being accepted at feedingamerica.org/coronavirus. Brought to you by the Ad Council and Feeding America. 200 food banks strong.
Broadcasting from the campus of Henry Ford College, this is WHFR Dearborn. Listener-supported, non-commercial radio, featuring local and independent artists.
Clarksdale.